He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo. 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Now that's a speech, FDR, his first inaugural address. 82 years ago, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Good morning, New York. How you all doing? 8 minutes after 10 o'clock. It is another yucky, wet, chilly day in the big city.
How unusual is this crappy weather? I mean, give me some historic perspective. We're talking history. What's the historic perspective?
Well, we were talking history when we talked about how cold February was. But in terms of winter
weather...
So how
cold was February?
It was the second or third coldest on record in New York City. But when you talk about winter weather, people forget because you just get aggravated. You're sick of the weather come March. But the fact of the matter is, we've had winter storms in March before. In fact, last year, we had the storm coming in tonight that'll last until tomorrow morning. But last year on March 2nd, we had a snowstorm here where we got 3 inches of snow.
So it's just our usual misery at this time of year.
We just get sick of it. The one thing that's different this year is the temperature isn't what it normally is. This time, today, we'll hit what is the normal temperature for this time of year in the low 40s.
Low 40s.
Yeah,
oh,
so,
that's good.
So, but then it's messy. You know what? The next 24 hours are bad.
1993, talking about great speeches, candidate Netanyahu claimed that Iran would have nuclear weapons by 1999. So 1993, Netanyahu first invokes the Iran nuclear threat, saying that they'll have the bomb by 1999, 15 years ago. That according to the New York Times. That was a great speech Netanyahu made in 1993 also. And it has been the central tenet in all Bibi's campaigns since. And I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, and you know me for over 40 years, almost 45 years now. This is my 45th year. I have to tell you again, despite all the hate mail that I've been getting in the last several weeks on this issue, all the callers that call filled with vitriol and anger and accusations, I cannot stand when people invoke the Holocaust to make a contemporary political point. You don't like President Obama's politics when it comes to these negotiations with Iran and the nukes? Fine. But to couch it in the language of the Nazi extermination of the Jewish people in World War II is just wrong. Never again? The slaughter of Europe's Jews? To use that as a rhetorical ploy, I think is unforgivable. What are we talking about here? We're talking about Nazis? Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, what does that have to do with Iran? Are we talking about Germany getting an A-bomb here? And if we're not talking about Germany getting the A-bomb, what does that have to do with Iran? It is so easy to fall back on that horror. It's just like racism. To use that, every time there's a person of color gets in a jam, it's racism. After a while, racism, that expression means nothing. The same thing with people that oppose an Israeli political point and they're anti-Semites or self-hating Jews. Absolutely unforgivable. We're going to debate that. We'll talk about that. But right now, we're very pleased to have Ryan Nobles on the program, the CNN correspondent, one of the team they have covering Bibi's speech and the reaction to it. Ryan, what's the reaction, generally speaking? Is it strictly along partisan lines, Democrats falling one way, Republicans another?
It is for the most part, Geraldo, and that's exactly what we expected. You know, Democrats don't appear to be inspired at all by what Netanyahu had to say, and Republicans are using this as a way to shore up their conservative base, and it was definitely a win for John Boehner in that respect. The Speaker of the House has had a difficult time kind of marshaling all the different factions within his party. If there were one area that I think kind of had an interesting reaction to the speech, it would be conservative Democrats, like, for instance, West Virginia's Joe Manchin, who was in attendance at the speech and actually applauded and seemed to support a lot of what Netanyahu had to say, which would probably go along with the voters in his state. But for the most part, you're absolutely right. I don't think that too many people were moved or their positions changed much, despite how impressive Netanyahu's speech was.
It definitely was impressive. I mean, the guy can spin a yarn. There's no doubt he is extremely eloquent, and we admire that. Ryan Nobles of CNN is our guest. He's covering the reaction to what was a historic speech, no doubt about it. What kind of history it cuts, I think, obviously, there are differing opinions about that, different forecasts about that. But now, Ryan, you have Mitch McConnell introducing or having one of the senators introduce legislation that will prevent the president from making a deal absent Congress's approval of the deal. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, and what's interesting about this piece of legislation, Geraldo, is it kind of gets us right into that same rut that we're in Washington, right? So they'll introduce a piece of legislation that will kind of attempt to put the brakes on President Obama's direct negotiations with Iran. But like everything in Washington, you are still going to have a partisan battle over this, and particularly in the Senate, where pretty much the ability to get anything out of that House requires 60 votes, and the Republicans just don't have the 60 votes necessary to get it out of that stage. It certainly could pass in the House, but then any piece of legislation that has to be signed by the president makes it difficult for Republicans to get anything passed. So like much of what happens here in Washington, especially over the past, really the last 4 years, or even specifically since the Republicans took control of the Senate, a lot of it is theater, and a lot of it is designed to play to the bases of these politicians. And I think this piece of legislation falls in line with that.
I agree with that. Ryan Nobles of CNN. Finally, how does this impact, or what's the betting in Washington on whether or not this is sabotages or forecloses a possibility of a deal with Iran in Switzerland in these negotiations?
Well, I think the administration remains just as focused on trying to get a deal done as they did before Netanyahu said anything to Congress. The question is, how does it impact Iran? The Iranian government was very upset with the language that Netanyahu used in that speech yesterday, and they have fought back against that vigorously. And, you know, with negotiations that are as tense as the ones that we're dealing with now, any little thing can derail the process and end up having it be completely derailed and not go forward. So, you know, I think the administration, and this is a signature, it's a legacy effort by the Obama administration. They're not going to give up on it, but it'll be interesting to see how the Iranians react.
Ryan Nobles, excellent report. I appreciate it, mate. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Ryan Nobles of CNN. Okay, what do you think? I know what you think. But here's Judy in Brooklyn, our friend. We'll start with a friend. Hi, Judy.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know, I'm going to be on so fast. This is scary. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, listen. Derail. I hope that thing is derailed. Guess what? Because it's not transparent. We don't know what deals they're making behind our backs. And this is too important. It's too much at stake for this. But let me just say this, Pharrell. I have a few things to say. Could you let me say my piece?
Go ahead, honey. But, you know, don't hog the air. But go ahead.
I'm going to try. Number one, do you remember Scud missiles? Where did they go? They didn't go to Honolulu. They went to Israel.
No, it was in Israel. They gave back gas masks to everybody. Very ineffective. The Scuds landed on nothing, as far as I remember.
Hello, Geraldo. Number two, do you know which is the bestseller right now in all the Middle East except for Israel?
What?
Mein Kampf. Number three, who walked away from
What's your source on that?
Peace agreement? Listen to me. Who walked away from the peace agreement? You know, Palestinian-Israel peace agreements. Was it Israel or was it Arafat and Abbas? Israel was ready to sign peace agreements. So you're always so hard on Israel.
You're getting too big here. You got to focus on what we're talking about, Iran and the nuclear talks.
Exactly.
Do you want to debate the whole Middle East peace negotiation?
So here's my point.
Okay, now you got to make it in a hurry.
Here's my point. This is my point. When they give threats that they're going to annihilate, God forbid, Israel. They mean it. They mean it. And we can't afford protocol here. I don't understand why you're so upset and focused on protocol when there's so much more important.
To me, it's bigger than that. Okay, honey, you had your chance. Thank you very much. I think that to invoke the Holocaust is a sin, unless it has to do with Germany and the Nazis. This has nothing to do with that. Everybody wants to annihilate Israel. How do you annihilate Israel without annihilating the United States and the rest of the world? I mean, let's get serious here. You know what my proposal has always been? We should incorporate Israel into the United States of America. Make it the 51st state. We have already said that an attack on Israel would be considered an attack on the United States. There is no annihilation of Israel without the annihilation of the United States, the Western world, the planet as we know it. These rhetorical flourishes by these crazy mullahs have nothing to do with the way business is truly conducted between states. And for Bibi to minimize the ISIS threat, the Sunni Muslim threat, and to say the enemy of my enemy is my enemy, that means that the Iranians that are right now fighting ISIS, are they our enemies? The United States is coordinating airstrikes against ISIS with Iran right now. I want Iran's help in defeating ISIS. ISIS is cutting off the heads of our people. They're burning people. They're eradicating Christians right now. Ask the Christians of the Middle East who they fear most. Is it Iran and the nuclear weapons? Ask the Christians. Ask the Christians against whom a genocide is truly being carried out right now.
Get Geraldo now. Get in on New York's most important stories. 866-GERALDO, 77 WABC.
Whether or not Netanyahu achieved his goals of sabotaging a deal with Iran, one thing is certain. The in-chamber response to this speech was by far the longest blowjob a Jewish man has ever received.
John Stewart. He's saying it like it is. A very, very funny reaction to the speech. I think substantively I agree with him, but what do you think? Let me tell you a story. Welcome back, everybody. 27 minutes after, you listen to 77 WABC. I'm Geraldo along with Noam Layden. When 9/11 happened, the iconic video of the towers collapsing then became the B-roll, as they say, to every learned commentary in the days after the disaster, the attacks. And then it became almost sloppy in the way they were used. Almost any reference to either Osama bin Laden or the war in Afghanistan at that time, or the war on terror, as it was called, would be wallpapered with that iconic shot of the towers collapsing. Finally, Roger Ailes, my sainted boss at Fox News, says, wait a second, we're overusing that, and it would deprive it of meaning if you keep using it. You have to be very circumspect and respectful when you use that video. Why do I bring that up? I feel the same way about charges of racism. You make the charge over and over and again. And wait, you're not talking about Selma or Jackson, Mississippi, or the police shootings. It's like used for almost every. There's a slight in the workplace, in school, unequal treatment for whatever reason. Racism, racism, racism. So the expression now raises defensive hackles in people who have tired of its overuse. Anti-Semitism is another of those expressions. Anytime a Jewish person or institution is in any way shortchanged, the same thing happens. Anti-Semite, 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 self-hating Jew, all these kinds of expressions become meaningless. They dilute their essential meaning. The Holocaust is a sacred memory branded on the soul of the Jewish nation. Not Israel, the worldwide Jewish community. It is something that is now in our DNA. We will never forget it. It is something that has affected and altered the way we exist on this planet. You cannot invoke the Holocaust
whenever there is a slight or a threat to either Israel or Jews or anti-Semitism in France, whatever, you can't again say this is another Holocaust. You can't use that expression. Holocaust has a capital H for a reason. It denies, it defies, rather, a specific horror that happened. And for political commentators to reference the Holocaust, I think they should pay a fee every time they use that word, and it should be donated to Bad Vashem or some. It cannot be used as a political, rhetorical flourish to make a point.
Geraldo on the 77 WABC app. Get it before you really need it. WABCradio.com.
At 11:30, welcome back. It's 10:37. I'm going to get to your calls momentarily. 866 Geraldo. I appreciate that people have called, and I haven't even given the number out. I love you. I do. I think that the smartest audience in all radio land. I say that unabashedly. I know that you disagree with me from time to time, particularly when it comes to Israel and all that. But we are generally respectful of each other. Everybody is welcome here. And I know that immigration also. Well, I could start listing things that most of you disagree with me on, but I just love that you're here. The Christian genocide that I mentioned, I'm going to have an expert on that at the bottom of the next hour at 11:30. We're going to talk about how, just most recently, 140 villagers in this Assyrian Christian community were taken captive, abducted by ISIS. What happened to them and what the forecast is in the ISIS-controlled territories for the Christians. At least 300, another report has here, 300 Christians in Syria kidnapped last week. So we'll get to that at the bottom of the hour. One of the prominent guests in the Capitol yesterday to listen to Bibi Netanyahu's historic speech. He's also the best attorney in the country, dear friend of ours. We welcome Professor Alan Dershowitz to the program. How you doing, Professor?
I'm doing great. It was really interesting to be sitting next to Sarah Netanyahu and Elie Wiesel and Marion while the speech was taking place.
Give us some color, some flavor.
Well, Sarah Netanyahu was there.
That's the wife of Bibi.
The wife of Bibi and her son. And they had flown in the day before. And they were nervous because this was a very important speech. And I think what surprised everybody was not a bombastic speech. He came up with a particular proposal, a specific proposal, which he said he could live with. He wouldn't like it, but he can live with it.
And now restate that very specifically.
I'll quote it for you exactly. If the world leaders are not prepared to insist that Iran change its behavior before a deal is signed, at the very least they should insist that Iran change its behavior before a deal expires. So here was his proposal. Go forward with the deal. We don't like it, but we'll accept it. But before you end the deal and allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons, insist that they do three things. Number one, stop being the world's greatest exporter of terrorism. Number two, stop intruding in countries like Syria and Lebanon and Yemen. And number three, stop calling for the extermination of the nation state of the Jewish people, Israel. And if you don't satisfy those three conditions, then the sunset provision will not kick in and the deal will extend beyond 10 years. Perfectly rational. The President of the United States ignored it, said there was nothing new. I was there. That's new. That's real.
All right, let me go through the 3 points because I noted them also. In terms of stopping terrorism,
right
now, is it not a fact that, is, for example, Iranian military help in Iraq, is that terrorism?
No, I'm talking about terrorism.
I mean, who's going to define these?
I'm talking of blowing up the Jewish Community Center in Argentina.
All right, that was
I'm
1982.
Blowing up the Marine Barrack in Lebanon.
That was 1983.
Yeah, I'm talking about the kinds of terrorism that we know Iran is still promoting. And in their speeches by the mullahs, they talk about it. So,
we recognize the right of Israel to exist as a sovereign nation,
absolutely.
Would
I'd
that do it?
I'd be in favor of the deal. I'd be in favor of the deal. And Netanyahu has said he could live with that deal. And if they stopped doing all the terrible things they're doing. They're the worst.
What do you think? And I have so much I want to talk to you about. What do you think the lasting takeaway impact, Professor Alan Dershowitz is our esteemed guest, is of Bibi's speech? What do you think? I mean, first of all, does it, and if I have to, you have to give me the shorter side of the answer because I have so much ground to cover. Does it impact the Israeli elections 2 weeks hence?
I don't think so. I think it's a tie on the Israeli elections. You know, the Israeli media goes after Bibi mercilessly, and they went after him yesterday mercilessly. I think the big impact, it was a civics lesson, and that's why what Pelosi said was so outrageous. It was a civics lesson. A civics lesson that said, look, Congress is as important as the president. We have co-equal branches of government. And I'm here, he said, to tell you that you in Congress have to take some responsibility for the most important foreign policy of the 21st century. Let's assume that the Democratic-controlled Senate had invited Chirac to come and talk to them when Bush was going to start a war with Iraq, and Chirac had said to Congress...
French leader.
Yeah, the French leader. Don't allow your president to start a war with Iraq. It's a bad idea. That would have been a great thing. It's very important precedent.
So you know that would have outraged all the Republicans back in 2003. But is it Bibi's place to give America a civics lesson, Professor?
Yes. I think, first of all, it's very important for Congress to understand, and I had long talks with several members of Congress about that, who don't seem to understand that under our Constitution they are equal to the president. The Speaker of the House and the president have co-equal responsibility.
Okay, I think that it was an amazing intrusion, but I think the Republicans are to blame, not Bibi.
Well, you know, you can say that, but if the Democrats had done the same thing,
I think the Democrats would have been
to blame.
On
the other foot, and I would hope the Democrats would do that if there was a Republican president. It's very
important. All right, now this is another thing. Now you and I love each other.
Yeah.
I think to invoke the Holocaust in this context is really a cheap shot.
I don't think
that the Holocaust has anything to do with these debates.
There are 6 million Jews who live in Israel today. He quoted Mashal, the head of Hezbollah, saying, I hope all the Jews of the world come to Israel so that we don't have to chase them like the Nazis did and kill them. This is an existential threat to the Jewish people.
Now, how is it an existential threat to the Jewish people and not to the world generally? You think they're going to have a surgical nuclear strike?
Yes.
It's not going to be answered by the United States. Won't involve Russia and China and the other nuclear powers and be the end of the world.
What good is it to have the United States respond? It's like building Holocaust museums after the 6 million have died. This is an effort to prevent Iran from doing what Rafsanjani said they would do. Rafsanjani, who was a liberal, said that when Iran develops a bomb, it will bomb Tel Aviv, kill 3 to 5 million Jews.
And what Israel will happen
will,
after they bomb
Israel
Tel Aviv and kill 3 to 5 million?
Israel will retaliate kill 10 to 20 million Muslims. And he said the trade-off would be worth it because it would be the end of the Jewish state.
It would be the end of the world
survive.
Is what it would be.
Well, you know, and that we want to see if we can stop that.
Well, I'm for that, but I'm not for invoking the Holocaust.
This is very much like...
You think it was a net positive to the cause?
Say it again?
You think it was a net positive to the cause of... keeping Iran from obtaining this.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think
all right. Let me stop you there. Okay. That's it. We got
their minds yesterday.
Okay.
Yep.
You think that minds were changed?
Yes.
Okay. Professor Alan Dershowitz thinks minds were changed and that it's a net positive for the negotiations. You can debate that. That's what Professor Alan Dershowitz, the esteemed professor, says on that issue. Now I have to jump to the Supreme Court of the United States today.
Yeah.
And the argument over Obamacare. And this challenge to the subsidies in Obamacare, if the subsidies go, half of the people or more who have gotten Obamacare coverage will lose that coverage. Give me Professor Alan Dershowitz's forecast. Which way will the Supreme Court vote on whether or not it is constitutional or legal, I should say, for Obamacare to provide those subsidies? In other words, the fate of the program itself is in the balance. How will the court?
Well, it's up to one person. It's up to Chief Justice
Roberts
of the United States Supreme Court, a former student at Harvard Law School, very brilliant and very tactical. He saved Obamacare last time around in a 5-4 vote. The question is, can he be persuaded to change his mind this time? I think he's going to stick with his vote, and I think we're going to see it 5-4 again. Upheld. It would be a disaster if it was struck down. It would mean the end of, you know, health care to so many people that need it. I think one of the signature contributions of the Obama administration has been health care. And even if I disagree with him, as I do on some foreign policy issues, I completely support him on the issue of health care. And it would be a political decision of the worst kind for a Republican-dominated Supreme Court to strike down the Democrat signature accomplishment that has helped so many American people.
How do you think the president felt about your being in the chamber yesterday?
Well, I would hope
you're his pal.
Supportive. I want to see this as a bipartisan issue. And I think one of the reasons that I was put in the front right near Sarah Netanyahu was to make it clear that this is a bipartisan issue.
Who put you
Democrats
there?
Democrats like Menendez. I just got assigned the seat, but I'm sure it was decided by the Prime Minister's office to have me sit next to the Prime Minister's wife. And I think it was important to send the message that it's not Republicans versus Democrats, but it's Democrats like Schumer and Menendez and others like me who are critical, who like the president, who support him, but are critical of some provisions. Look, I want a deal. I don't want war. I want to negotiate a deal, but I want a deal that doesn't allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons in 10 years if they haven't changed their policies. And that's what Netanyahu said he would accept. I think the burden has now shifted to the president to explain why our negotiators won't ask Iran to accept a conditional sunset provision rather than an absolute sunset provision, which makes so much sense.
Loud and clear. Alan Dershowitz, a pleasure always. I'll see you soon, buddy.
To be with you. Thank you.
Power award information, go to jdpower.com.
The headlines, the city's most pressing issues. Geraldo, today and every day, 77 WABC.
This is a short segment, 54 minutes after 10 o'clock, so let me take as many calls as I can. Dave in New Jersey, thank you very much for calling, Dave.
Yeah, not a problem. Geraldo, I believe that BB hit one out of the park yesterday. I mean, you know, and his most important point was that, you know, here in America, we're fighting for our security. Israel is fighting for their survival.
Okay, good point, Dave. Got it. How about James on Long Island? Hey, James.
Good morning, Geraldo. How are you?
Thanks for calling.
This is what I don't understand. I could never imagine a leader of a country using chemical weapons on their own people, or somebody strapping a bomb to themselves just to blow up. There are people that believe their kingdom is waiting for them on the other side.
True.
And I'm not talking about your regular people. I'm talking about your mullahs, your fanatics. So I don't understand what's to stop them. If they believe their glory is waiting for them, what's to stop them from...
You mean what's to stop a state from becoming as fanatic as these individual jihadists are?
Because they believe what they believe. They believe truly in their hearts that it's their mission to destroy Israel. If they believe that, if Iran truly believes that, then what's to stop the mullahs from saying, you know what? Yes, we are willing to sacrifice our people for the glory that's waiting
for us. Well, that's the existential fear the world has, James, that one of these terrorist groups like ISIS will gain the power of a state and perpetrate horrors worldwide. That's why I am so frustrated by Bibi's choice of who the prime enemy is. Is Iran really the existential threat? Or is ISIS, Iran, a Shiite Muslim country, the Shiite Muslims, are they the existential threat? Or is it the Sunni Muslim extremist group, ISIS? I mean, there's no connection between the Shiite and the Sunni. They hate each other. I think therein lies a lot of the instability. We haven't even talked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how disruptive that is to peace. But the issue of whether or not a state like the Islamic State, ISIS, could get nuclear capability, just think about that one if you want to be horrified. That, to me, is much more of an existential threat to the planet than Iran is. But your call, so much to go today. Don't go away.
He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
We must all stand together to stop Iran's march of conquest, subjugation, and terror.
The alternative that the Prime Minister offers is no deal, in which case Iran will immediately begin once again pursuing its nuclear program.
The president coming out as soon as Bibi had left the lectern, coming out and giving a very forceful rebuttal. You mean, love him or hate him, he didn't ignore Bibi's speech. I mean, he ignored it to the extent that he refused to meet with the Israeli prime minister coming to this country. invited by the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the Republican faction in the Congress of the United States. But he certainly did not wait, the President of the United States, to give his forceful rebuttal, basically saying that Bibi has been wrong in the past. He's exaggerated in the past how soon it would be before Iran had a nuclear weapon. Stories in the New York Times today point out that candidate Netanyahu in 1993 said Iran would have a nuclear weapon by 1999, 15 years ago. That, of course, has not happened. Me personally, I think that there is an inevitability when it comes to technology. You can try your best to suppress it over time. It's going to happen no matter what. I mean, how in the world did North Korea get nuclear capability? Nuclear nonproliferation is a priority worldwide for sure. You definitely don't want a terrorist group. I mean, that's the nightmare I have, that some terrorist group gets nuclear capability, not a national player, but an individual jihadi. They get a suitcase nuke and they take it to Grand Central. I mean, that's the horror that the world faces. I don't think that Israel is particularly vulnerable to the weapon, the ultimate weapon of mass destruction, because I think once a state attacks another state, there is no stopping it. It won't be bilateral. It'll be universal. At the bottom of the hour, I'm sure that to Christian listeners, all this obsession with Israel and the fate of the Jewish people, they may say, hey, what about us? Well, at the bottom of the hour, there is a real Holocaust going on, or a genocide, or at least the beginnings of one in the Middle East. And it's directed at Christians, Christians in Syria, in territory controlled by ISIS. You know what is happening? 300 kidnapped last week. I mean, some released, I don't know why, some have been released, some of the Assyrian Christians have been released by ISIS, others have been mowed down. Christianity, it's interesting, Noam, because I've been covering the Middle East. I'm going to get to your calls momentarily, ladies and gentlemen, and this whole half hour is yours. I'm going to bring you in. In 1970, when I started covering the Middle East, or actually, I didn't get there until 1972. In 1973, Yom Kippur War and all that. There was a thriving Christian community in, like, Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus. It was a very big Palestinian Christian community through much of the West Bank, through all, I mean, the
Syria, for sure.
Egypt, Egypt, they say more than 10% of the population. Still, I mean, Egypt still has a substantial Christian population. But there is a pogrom going on against Christians now in these ISIS-controlled territories. And the feeling being directed at Christians in the Holy Land is how unwelcome they are. It's almost as if the president had a clumsy mention of the Crusades. But there's a crusade going on against Christians right now in the Middle East, in these Middle Eastern countries, where they have been driven out, or being driven out, in the way Jews were driven out, or Jews fled in 1948 at the creation of Israel, leaving Kuwait and Yemen and so forth, and coming Morocco and coming to Israel. Now the Christians, where are they going to go? I mean, what nations will welcome the Christians, the Assyrian Christians? Where will they go? You know, is the United States now going to declare Assyrian Christians refugees? They should. You know, where are the Christians going to go? Anyway, we're going to talk about the Holocaust against Christianity in the Middle East at the bottom of the hour, at 11:35 to be precise. All right, but now let's take your calls at 866-HERALDO. You know what we have been talking about, and there's so much more to talk about. I mean, the world has been a very busy place, and I really, you know, this I have one eye on what the Supreme Court is doing right now with Obamacare, and also as someone who contemplated running for the Senate in the Garden State of New Jersey, it is interesting to me to see the diminished fortunes of Chris Christie, who was, for all his, the criticism of his bluster, was flying high prior to Bridgegate. Now it is 35% of registered voters in New Jersey say they approve of Chris Christie. I think you can forget about another Republican governor in New Jersey for a long time because of this lowest approval rating ever for Chris Christie, highest disapproval rating, 51% disapprove.
So he's got numbers that are worse than President Obama's were at the worst for President Obama. Okay, but back to the subject at hand. We're obviously talking about Bibi's speech before the Congress of the United States. The very partisan response to the speech, Republicans and conservatives more generally highly approving of his speech. Mitch McConnell saying that the Republicans will offer legislation on a fast track that would tie the president's hands to sign any agreement with Iran over nuclear non-proliferation absent the consent of Congress. I'm sure that the president will veto that. I'm sure the Senate of the United States, Mitch McConnell will never get 60 votes in the Senate to stop debate on that one. But there is a bill nonetheless, and there is reaction now. How appropriate or inappropriate was Bibi coming here to speak? How appropriate or inappropriate was the invocation of the Holocaust in this context? There is, really impassioned reaction already. The letters and emails that I've been getting, very angry, some even hate-filled, I must say. But I'm totally interested and engaged in what you have to say. I'll start with Pat on Long Island. Hey, Pat, what are you thinking about?
Good morning, Geraldo. What I'm thinking about is I thought it was totally inappropriate. I am a Republican, but I thought it was totally inappropriate.
And why is that, Pat?
To invite Netanyahu to address Congress and not even tell our president. I'm not an Obama supporter at all, quite frankly. Didn't vote for him. But I think, he's our president, and we must be respectful. And for someone from the head of another country to come and tell our Congress and tell us, by extension, what we should be doing is totally inappropriate. And, it bothers me, too, that people who will call you and speak with you, and because you disagree, they call you a self-hating Jew. I think that's such a terrible thing.
I thank you for that.
Absolutely.
And I got Purim coming up, and now I got the Levy family's going to be all over me. Thank you. Excellent call, Pat. I appreciate it. Well, excellent call, but I feel your love. Thank you. Hey, Bob in Long Island, what do you think about, Bob?
I wanted to make a comment on the Prime Minister's speech. He came here, and he basically, he kind of did the president disrespect, but the other countries are also involved. I believe that Russia's involved in those talks.
They are.
China and Germany.
They are.
Those countries have supplied Iran with the nuclear centrifuges and the equipment to build those nuclear reactors.
Interesting point.
So why does he come here and bang on my drum and basically short of we should have boots on the ground or we should protect Israel by stopping Iran? I want to make a comment. I have family in the service. My daughter went over, and she does not come back the same. I don't want to see any more American kids go over to those countries and get involved in wars while the countries that you're protecting are doing business with the very people that you're cursing at. I believe that what they should do is, and the world should do it, not deal with Russia, not deal with China. You see what happened with Alibaba? Everybody throws a great company. Now they find out that the government is behind it. Stop dealing with these countries. Wall Street has to be involved in this, and mostly the people who are offending these countries with the remarks, the anti-Semitic remarks, with wanting to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. They should not do business with them. Cut the music off, and then, like he says, walk away and get a better deal. Well, you can get a better deal if you stop feeding their economy.
I got you. Thank you very much, Bob. A very, very thoughtful call. Let's see. Where's Gordon? Gordon is here's Gordon. Hey, Gordon, what are you thinking about?
Geraldo, first-time caller. I just wanted to say that on the whole Israel issue, that I just think you're right on. You're being very fair, and you're not choosing sides. You're just telling it like it is. And I notice you get a lot of negative callers, but there's a lot of people out there that really appreciate having your voice, and how you speak up.
Well, Gordon, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. That's about the nicest thing I've heard. I need it. It's funny. It's you can always pick an easy issue. I think that, for instance, if you're against undocumented immigration or what? I mean, that doesn't take any courage to say, the immigrants are mucking up everything. They're bringing disease. And, you know, that doesn't take, to support Israel doesn't take any courage. I mean, it really doesn't. Everybody supports Israel. Everybody wants secure borders. You know, when you step out of line in this business, it's a very, very lonesome feeling. And you sometimes you think, you know, why do I cause myself this sorrows when it would be so easy for me to either be go with the flow, right on, yeah, tell it like it is, Holocaust Day, or be neutral. The leader came, he spoke, the reaction was such and such and so forth, and on the other hand was this force and that one. But to take a position when it comes to these incendiary issues, I get it. The hoodie. I get it. I don't, when I tell you what my position is on the particular issue, it's because it is heartfelt. And because if at this point in my life, I can't be frank and I can't tell you how I think, then why would I stay in public life? You know, I would go to Florida. I'd get a tan, drink margaritas. You know, why do I need this? Or if I had this job and I really wanted to play it, how easy is it to play it? To take the Drudge Report talking points and go with them all day long.
Plenty of people do that.
Plenty of people do that. That's not me. And that's why you're listening.
Geraldo, the truth behind the story for New York. Live, local, on it. 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
25 minutes after 11 o'clock, this hour of Geraldo brought to you by Medwell, the esteemed pain relief clinic. Medwell.
All right, what are you thinking about? One thing I just before I get to your calls, the Hillary Clinton private email flap, I haven't gotten my arms around it yet in the sense that if factually all of the emails have been retained, preserved, and are accessible on a server someplace, I think that whether it was Gmail or the government account should not matter for Hillary Clinton. If, however, she has intentionally destroyed those emails or made them inaccessible by using the private account, then I think she's in trouble. What irks me is, and I'm going to get to your calls, and I know the topic du jour is Bibi and Israel and the nuclear talks and so forth. But I have to say that I believe Benghazi has been thoroughly investigated six ways to Sunday, and to keep bringing it up diminishes it. Remember I talked about the footage of the World Trade Center falling? The mention of Benghazi by these House Republicans, Benghazi, this and that, Benghazi, it has made it mean nothing. They have cheapened the tragedy and made it a political talking point. I get the creeps. It grosses me out when I hear Daryl Issa or even Trey Gowdy, who I have some admiration for. He's a good prosecutor, he was. When I hear these guys, Benghazi, I say, oh, God. The last thing America needs right now is for the Congress of the United States to do nothing but investigate Benghazi for the 14th or 15th time. It's like passing a law to abolish Obamacare that they know is going to go no place. In other words, doing nothing substantive to help improve the plight of America and the working people and so forth. But if she was cheating on the emails and destroying the emails, they may have found what they were looking for in the Benghazi hearings from the get-go, a way to wound Hillary Clinton. In other words, if the goal, the secret, unannounced political agenda was always to diminish Hillary and her candidacy, then this may have given them the ammo that they need. I mean, I don't know. It's a fact question that I think needs to be answered. And again, I stress, if these private emails of Hillary Clinton are accessible, if they have been retained on a server someplace, then no, just a lot of noise about nothing. If she has destroyed those Remember the whole thing with Lois Lerner and the IRS and emails and so forth? I mean, you can't destroy evidence. And if she has, then she's in trouble. If she hasn't, and it should be relatively easy to find out, I know that they're saying, or supporters are saying, that the emails are preserved, then let's put them out there. All right, that's it. Then next scandal. But I saw the way Jeb Bush seized on it immediately, saying Rand Paul seized on it immediately. So the campaign is totally engaged right now. And it's going to be a sleazy, dirty, down and out, you know, drag mud. I almost said some bad words there, but it's it's going to be awful.
So no different than any other year, basically.
I wonder if against Hillary particularly, I wonder if it's not going to be more and worse. That's what I'm thinking about. Anyway, I talked through your time. I'm sorry. We're going to talk about the Christian Holocaust after Noam's newscast. But I promise you I'm going to save time for any callers I haven't gotten to yet. And I appreciate that you've been ringing the phones off the hook today.
Live, local, on it, 866 Geraldo, where New York comes to talk, 77 WABC.
They may call you doctor, or they may call you chief. You're gonna have to save somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to save somebody.
Save somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
In 1983, I was in southern Lebanon when I first heard that song. We were with a group of Christian Lebanese, a militia group that was fighting against Hezbollah. Although I don't even know if Hezbollah had that name at that point, but they basically was fighting against the Shiite militias there in southern Lebanon. Very heroic people. Major Haddad, the name hit me. So funny, I hadn't thought about that name in so many years. But they were in a Beaufort castle, a crusader castle. They were besieged in the castle, the Christian fighters were. And there were some reinforcements across the valley, but there were the militias, the extremist militias, the Muslim extremist militias, between the Christian forces that were trying to supply the embattled Beaufort castle. And I got to ride in an armored personnel carrier, one of the Christians' armored personnel carriers, down into the valley, then back up to the castle strong point. And I remember so vividly the rounds, the small arm rounds hitting the APC.
Wow.
It was one of the most dramatic experiences, you know, at that time, certainly. I mean, there have been so many since with Iraq and Afghanistan. This is back in 1983. But when we aired the piece on 2020, we used that Bob Dylan song that you just heard. He recorded that when he was converting to Christianity. You know, he's Robert Zimmerman, born Jew, and then he converted to Christianity. I think he converted back. I don't know what his religion is right now, but it was that 10 minutes there that he was a Christian, and you got to serve somebody. And in the context of today's discussion, it's kind of relevant to remember that this is not anything new that's going on now. This really is a centuries-old phenomenon in the Middle East. But I just want to read you something that our next guest wrote about a particular incident. Even in the weary newsrooms that have reported one beheading after another, a new low was reached on Sunday, February 15th, 2015, when ISIS warriors released a well-produced video complete with Hollywood-style camera angles on the shores of the Mediterranean, apparently near Tripoli, Libya, 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians were beheaded for their faith alone. It claimed to be prepared as, quote, a message signed with blood to the nation of the cross, close quote. It wasn't just a message for the Middle East. It was a message sent to all Christians everywhere. All right, that comes from a new prologue to the book Defying ISIS by the humanitarian and author who joins us now, Johnny Moore. Johnny, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Geraldo. Thanks for having me.
All right. So tell me about, do you believe that there is a systemic effort going on now, spearheaded by ISIS,
to eliminate the Christian community in the areas of conflict?
Yeah, of course I do, and that's why I wrote the book. And you know, one of the points I make in the book is the point you were making moments ago. You know, this is not a new thing. It's an old thing. I mean, 30 years ago, you were witnessing that in Lebanon, and so ISIS very, very much feels like they're finishing something which others started and weren't able to finish. And there's just piece of evidence after piece of evidence. Now, Geraldo, they're equal opportunity psychopaths. They've killed more Muslims than anybody else, Yazidis and Kakais and Mandeans and all the minorities, but they take particular joy in killing Christians. And as they marched from across Iraq and Syria, they targeted Christian communities and Christian cities, and they've been very successful. I mean, in Mosul alone, for instance, for the first time in 1,600 years, there are no church bells ringing.
That is, to me, a very chilling statement by Johnny Moore, the author of Defying ISIS, Why Americans Should Be Paying Attention to What Could Be or Could Become the Biggest, Most Deadly Human Rights Event in Our Lifetime, the Eradication of the Christian Population in the Middle East. Johnny writes how thousands of women and children have been slaughtered, churches have been demolished, crosses burned and replaced with ISIS flags, homes destroyed, entire communities displaced, religious conversions forced, human torture enacted, human trafficking employed, journalists and aid workers beheaded, all in plain sight. Why is this not being dealt with, and what can and should we as Americans do about it? What should we do about it, Johnny?
Well, I think we've got to take it more seriously. It all begins with that. And you know, Geraldo, I get it, right? I mean, here we are in America, and you know, we all have nice lives, and we're working really hard to take care of our families, and that's over in Iraq and Syria. That's really, really far away. It's, you know, I feel bad for those people, but what can I do about it? But, you know, the fact is that as I write in Defying ISIS, you know, this is as much of a threat in our own backyard as it is in the cradle of Christianity, which is that region of the world. You know, when the video that ISIS produced when they beheaded those 21 cops, it was a message to the nation of the cross. And by the way, ISIS believes that anyone that lives in the United States or Europe, they're all Christians. That's the way they perceive it. It's one big crusader army. They don't get into the nuance of what particular type of Christian you are, even if you're a Christian at all. Because you live in the West, you're part of that club. And you know, and the really, really scary, scary thing about this whole situation is when you get inside of it, you know, you discover that there's much more of a threat here than we realize. You know, in Defying ISIS, I write about this amazing study that was produced out of the University of Milan. And Geraldo, you won't believe it. They analyzed Arabic language tweets with the word ISIS in it, and then they categorized it by country. And unbelievably, in the United States of America, 21% of the ISIS-related tweets in Arabic in this country were in support of ISIS. In Saudi Arabia, it was only 19%. I mean, this is a moment of history. We're watching a once-in-a-thousand-year threat against Christians in the Middle East. And the fact is that once they're done here, they'd like to do the same there. They'd like to do the same thing.
I agree with that. I think they are the real threat, particularly these lone actors who are motivated by what they have on social media, what they read on social media. One thing, you know, we see their viciousness and their violence. What's this whole thing about, you know, sex, slavery, and pornography? Are they really obsessed, as Bin Laden was, with pornography? What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally out of control. I mean, I actually have pictures of the price lists for the slave markets in Iraq. And by the way, they're characterized by religion. So they're literally selling women and children at discounted rates in Iraq and Syria right now because they have so many. The inventory is so high. And you can buy a 9-year-old Christian or Yazidi little girl, 9 years old, for $170.
Oh, my goodness.
It's just incomprehensible. And a 50-year-old woman costs $50. I mean, these are evil, evil people. And you know, and by the way, that's one of the points I make in the book, is that it's going to take the best of faith to defeat the worst of religion. You know, I just think these people are psychopaths. And
what should the church do? You think the Pope Francis, my favorite pope in a long time, do you think he's being effective in this?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he's speaking up about it, and the church has to do two things. They have to raise their voice. There are 2 billion Christians on planet Earth. We got to raise our voices. And number two, we're witnessing a massive, massive humanitarian crisis. I mean, the United Nations is the one that's calling this the greatest refugee crisis of our time. We've got millions and millions of people that have been displaced. And the fact is that these Christian churches in Iraq and Syria are basically the only humanitarian.
Oh, let me ask you this, Johnny. Johnny Moore is my guest, the author of Defying ISIS. Is it not a fact that in Egypt, with the authoritarian government, Christians were more protected than they were when you had democracy and the Muslim Brotherhood? And isn't Assad in Syria more caring or more protective of the Christians than the Sunni Muslims, the opponents of Assad's regime?
It's absolutely true. You know, Assad is an Alawite. He's a minority Muslim in a majority Sunni country, and the Christians were also minorities. They are minorities. And so, you know, this is where the region is really, really complex. And you know, the problem is with United States foreign policy, actually with global foreign policy at the moment, is we are not appreciating the nuance and the complexity. So we just think we can fly airplanes 30,000 feet in the air and drop bombs that's going to take care of the issue. But every way you turn the coin, it's really, really complicated. So that's where, you know, the White House is right, that it's going to have to be an Arab-led coalition. But the White House is wrong in that they believe, it seems, that they don't need the full support of the United States. I mean, one of the shocking things I discovered when I was in Iraq meeting with the Kurdish government was that the Peshmerga that everybody thinks is a saving grace against ISIS, they're fighting with Soviet-era weapons against ISIS, which is fighting with
I agree. It's lamentable how relatively muted our response. Johnny, I got to let you go. I'm out of time. Johnny Moore, terrific book, Defying ISIS. Has a Christian Holocaust begun? What to do about it? Johnny, I appreciate it. And ladies and gentlemen, I'll be right back with your calls.
Live and local, the Tri-State's most important issues with Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Just to give you a heads up, at 8 minutes, make that 7 minutes to high noon, 7 minutes to noon. I want to change it up tomorrow on tomorrow's program. Dr. Ben Carson, the noted neurosurgeon candidate for the Republican nomination for the presidency, has just proclaimed that being gay is a choice. It's a lifestyle choice. It's not a biological imperative, which is the general thought now, that being gay is a choice. I thought that was resolved years ago, but now it's front and center. We'll talk about that tomorrow. And that new sex report, fascinating. Everybody is talking about it. You know, talking about what the true average size of penises or peni. What's the plural?
I think we'll go with peni. I like that. Even if it's not correct, it sounds correct.
All right. So, what's the true average size of peni, and you know, the implications and how Viagra have absolutely changed the world. You know, upsetting. That's why millennials are so bitter that the baby boomers, you know, fueled by Viagra and Cialis and these other potent sex drugs have, you know, not been able to evolve into their God-given right to succeed the old-timers. Too many altacacas hanging in there. And the truth about men and sex. Okay, that's it. The truth about men and sex. And that author will be joining us at 10:30. 10:35 tomorrow, so don't miss that. Okay, let me squeeze in. Here's Lou in Queens. What's up, Lou?
You know, I'll just jump on your conversation you just had. The Christian population in the last 60 years in the Middle East has gone from about 20% of the population to 5% of the population.
Lamentable. Absolutely shocking.
Yeah, and it's been very, very underreported.
I agree with that, we're going to change that right here. We're going to change that up. But go ahead, what else?
Well, I just wanted to say something to your audience. Folks, you got to remember something about Geraldo. He's a real reporter that had a metal helmet on and a flak jacket. He's not a FaceTime guy, so respect him, even if we disagree with him sometimes.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. Oh, that, you know, I'm teary. I swear, I'm not. I mean, that's so nice. I appreciate that. Here's Paul. Paul, what's up, Paul?
Yeah, I just want to say, as a black American, I don't speak for all black people, but I speak to a lot that I know, and we can't wait until President Obama leaves office.
Why is that, Paul? Why is that?
We love him so much, and we're so proud of him, and the way people disrespect him is, like, it's disgusting.
All right. Well, and you think that, you know, well, you're glad and proud that he was elected, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. But I didn't know that he was going to get beat up like this. God, no, every 2 minutes is insane.
All right, I got you. Very well, again.
You have a prime minister comes over and disrespects the president, and people laugh. Like, even the president of Russia, like, they'd rather have him be the president. They talk nice about Putin and talk disgustingly about our president. It's disgusting.
I wonder, Paul, thank you very much for the call. Sincere and eloquently stated also. I wonder how widespread that feeling is. You know, just, hey, what the hell's going on here? Is this appropriate? You know, the foreign leader coming? I mean, is there a disrespect aspect to it? Is the partisan divide so bitter rather than racially? You see it in terms of partisanship. Is it so bitter that you could even do something that undermines and disrespects the president to score your partisan point? Not about Israel, not about race, but it's about scoring points, right, left, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican. We're going to call it out. We're going to call it like we see it. And I appreciate you, the smartest, the best, the most open-hearted audience in Radio Land, and I'll see you tomorrow.